Right, yeah, I will repeat what I said a minute ago. Let me start with saying thank you very much for inviting me here. It's really a pleasure for me being here. And the reason why my title was changed is because my flight was canceled, as many other flights yesterday. I had to spend some time in the airport, and I had 5 hours to do something and my laptop with me, so I was revising my talk and I changed title to slides. Yeah, but this has something to do only with the very last part of the talk. So.
Well, you can only say correct modifications of gravity.
Yeah, that's almost the same aerodynamics or cosmology. Okay, let me start. I will start with outlining what I'm going to speak today. I'm going to talk about the Banach-Strasser solution, which is a warp deformed conical solution. This is a solution of supergravity, which is built to particular n equal 1 gauge theory. And I will speak about recent generalizations of this solution. Actually, this solution was generalized in the whole one-dimensional family of new solutions we have found. And I will speak what about meaning of this family on a gauge theory side. Then after doing that, I will make a stop and ask you if you have some questions, and then I will move on. This should be the first part of the talk, the first half. And then in the second half, I will start putting various brains on the conifold, and I will start discussing what it means on a gauge side. And if I have enough time, I would love to discuss the blue balls in gauge theory, which can be probed in the supergravity through considering the fluctuation of supergravity. Okay, let me start with discussion of the Banach-Strasser solution. And I will start with corresponding gauge theory. This gauge theory is a certain n equal 1 supersymmetric gauge theory. It's not a pure gauge theory, it has extra fields, but before we jump to this extra fields, let me say a few words about renormalization group behavior. This gauge theory has two gauge groups, SUM plus M and SUM. Both N and M are very, very large, and actually they run to infinity, they're treated to be infinite, such that I can work in planar limit. I keep top constant to be finite. But what happens is that this is not a conformal, definitely not a conformal gauge theory, it is actually a confining gauge theory. So two coupling constants run as soon as I move my energy scale from UV to infrared. So I start moving my energy scale from UV to infrared, the coupling constants run, one of them runs to zero, another runs to infinity. At some point, at some scale, one of the coupling constants becomes infinite, and my microscopic description is not valid anymore. If I want to proceed with changing my effective energy scale, I need to do something with my microscopic description. And what people do, they just do Zeiberg duology, and they basically find another microscopic description for the same physical system. So the new Zeiberg dual description turns out to be of absolutely the same form. It has the same field content, the same structure, and the only difference is that the ranks of two gauge groups are different. The gauge group should be, both gauge groups should be shifted by M. So today I will focus on the situation when large M is proportional to large M, and then Zeiberg duality will shift both these numbers by M large. So effectively, Zeiberg duality changes k into k minus 1 when I run from UV to infrared. So what happens is that the physical system is still the same, but I have to switch from one microscopic description to another description. And since both these descriptions are the same, it is usable to think about that as if k were dynamical and k runs with the scale of the theory, or the energy scale of the theory. Okay, that's what I said was referring to cascade behavior in the gauge theory. And I won't speak about that today, but this cascade behavior and renormalization group behavior can easily be seen on a gravity side because you can match leading beta function coefficient through gauge theory calculation. Okay, so now let me discuss the content, the field content of this gauge theory a little bit. Maybe I should write a quiver. I won't discuss quivers today, but maybe it will help. I have two gauge groups, SU KM and SU K plus 1 M. And I have two fields, A and B. These are by fundamental fields. And actually, this is not only one field, but there are two fields, A, I, and B, J. I and J run from 1 to 2. And each of them marks fundamental representation of SU2 field, of SU2 symmetry group. But there is two SU2 groups, two independent SU2 groups, and I is a fundamental with respect to this one, and the singlet with respect to this one, and J is a singlet with respect to this one, is a doublet with respect to this one. So this is actually R symmetry of my theory. I need this extended R symmetry group to be able to construct gravity dual solution, because if I have a lot of R symmetries, I know that my gravity dual solution has to be symmetric under these symmetries, and I will be able to fix the shape of the manifold of compactification. Okay, so I also have Z2 symmetry, which basically changes A and B, and I also need to conjugate to inverse the direction of the error. So this is a trivial Z2 symmetry, but it will play somewhat important role in later consideration. Okay, so as I mentioned before, this gauge theory is confining, and on the last step of the cascade, let me go back for a second. As soon as I move to infrared, my k decreases, and at some point it becomes k just equal 1. I have SU2 2m cross SUm, and in the very last step of the cascade, it will end up with SUm, and this is confining gauge theory. So I need to construct a colorless object, and one of them is matrix of mesons. I still have a color index here, but I will get rid of it soon by taking trace the determinant of this matrix with respect to color index, and V runs from 1 to n. And I also have baryonic fields, and these fields are colorless. So mesons and baryons are the infrared content of my effective field theory.
There are no polyonic objects. There are no polyonic objects in what you work on here.
There are more than what I have here?
Like
what?
Anything which will put instead of A1, AB, 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 A.
I'm not sure I can do that because A and B have different directions here. So,
right. So you contract them with delta symbols and you leave two indices at the end open, and those you contract with epsilon symbols.
I wouldn't say that this object cannot be constructed, but I know the effective low energy superpotential. And I know that it is written in terms of these fields. So I'm not sure that the fields you refer to, even if they exist, I'm not sure they're important to low energy dynamics.
Yeah, that basically was a question, whether they're going to be important or not.
No, they're not. If I consider low energy setup, and if I'm just interested in modulized space, they're not important. If they exist, they definitely would be important for dynamics, but I will not discuss dynamics today. I will just discuss modulized space.
Okay.
Okay, so this is this low energy superpotential. It has the part which is responsible for dynamics of mesons, and it also has the following constraint. This is actually a constraint because the field X is an auxiliary field, and it has no kinetic curve such that on shell, this parenthesis, the guy in the parenthesis should be zero, and this constraint can be easily understood on classical level, because on classical level, internal scale of my theory is equal to zero, and I have that determinant of meson matrix should be equal to the product of baryons. If I take a step back here, I will see that the determinant of this matrix is equal to the product of these baryons, just because it's like simple linear algebra here. So this constraint, determinant of this guy is equal to A product B. This is just a trivial statement on a classical limit. On a quantum level, this constraint is deformed by internal scale of the theory, and mesonic field and baryonic fields, they're independent now. They're not a subject to constraint with zero here, but rather with lambda. Okay, so the solution to this constraint is the following. I have at least two branches here. I have the mesonic branch, which corresponds to baryonic fields equal to zero. And this is the equation I have for mesonic field. And I can parameterize my mesonic matrix, which is 2x2 matrix, because I already took a determinant with respect to color indices. And I can parameterize them with four complex coordinates. And then as a result of having this constraint, I will have the following constraint for my four coordinates. And this equation defines a three-dimensional manifold as a submanifold in C4. And this three-dimensional manifold is known as the deformed manifold. This is a complex manifold, a non-compact complex manifold, which admits a structure of Calabi-Yau. It admits Ricci flat metric. And you will see in a second that this deformed manifold is basically the key part of the Klebanov-Strasser supergravity solution. And the nice thing is that I recovered this geometry, this deformed manifold geometry, without knowing anything about ADS-CFT or just about knowing anything about gauge gravity quality. I just started with gauge theory, and by doing calculation in gauge theory, I recovered the geometry. So in that sense, this geometry is an emergent geometry.
Are you taking here that n equals to 1?
M?
The number of brains?
No. Number of brains should be somewhat infinite.
So the determinant of m contains many more variables.
Right. Well, the determinant of m has four variables because this determinant is a determinant with respect to color indices. I left SU2 indices, but color indices all integrated out in the determinant. Because this is confinement gauge theory, so I have to consider colorless objects.
Yeah, for many number of points, I can imagine that you have n copies of the same Hilbert space.
Yeah.
So is this what you are you thinking about, some symmetric product?
No, I'm just trying to understand the model space of the theory when all these brains turn out to be fluxes. This, I do not consider each particular brain as a probe brain. I consider all n brains as a source of my geometry. If I add one extra brain, then perhaps it can be described in this way as well. But I'm not doing that right now. I'm not considering each particular brain as a probe brain. I try to understand what kind of geometry they create. Altogether.
So you're saying you get the same geometry independent of the value of m?
Yeah, it's the same geometry independent of value of m. Yeah. I mean, assuming that I'm working in the Planck limit, so in that sense, m is taken to infinity. Okay. So now I have the baryonic branch, which corresponds to mesonic fields equal to zero, and then I have only one constraint, this one complex equation to be solved. And the solution is very simple. I can parameterize the solution with help of extra complex variable zeta. So my baryonic branch is just C1. It's a complex plane, which is parameterized by zeta. And it has Z2 symmetry. The Z2 symmetry turns A into B. And on the level of zeta, it moves zeta into zeta to minus 4. So zeta goes to zeta inverse. Zeta could be complex. But let us think about it as it is real, because the complex part, the complex argument, can be rotated away by help of baryonic symmetry. I will discuss it a little bit more on the next slide, I guess, maybe in two slides. Okay, let me shift gears and start speaking about the Klebanov-Strasser solution. It's a supergravity solution, which is a work product of four-dimensional space. And a deformed manifold, the Ricci flat metric on deformed manifold, which has appeared on the previous slide from gauge theory analysis that I already mentioned before. And it is known that this geometry is a gravity-dual geometry of the gauge theory before. there is a lot of there is a lot of evidence to that, and I don't want to discuss that because this is pretty much known. Let me just point out that the warp factor is not infinite at zero. It is actually finite at zero, and it means that I have confinement in my gauge theory. Okay, now I will briefly review the geometry of the Banach-Rutherford solution in some detail. I will be quick with that because I will not use many of these properties, but just to review them, I think it is important to name them. So this solution looks like a cone, especially we introduce the coordinate along the cone, which is the radius of the cone. So for large values of radius, this solution approaches the cone, the warp through a cone on T11. T11 is a symmetric space, which is SU2 cross SU2, factorized by U1. So it's a symmetric space. It has SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. So this radius along the cone, according to ADS field logic, can be identified with energy scale of my gauge theory. So in the UV regime, my solution is nothing else but the product of flat space and the cone with T11 as a base. And in the infrared regime, my solution is not singular as it should be, because initially what I have conic singularity, which is called it. Initially, I have a singularity, I add brains to it, and instead of having a singular conifold, I end up with deformed conifold. And at the tip, I do not have singularity anymore, but rather I have non-vanishing S3, a three-sphere of non-vanishing size, and there is flux which prevents this S3 to shrink, and this flux is exactly the number of brains, the fractional defined brains, and this is the same number as the number of colors in my gauge theory. So here I have sphere, here I have conic geometry, and this is the geometry of KS solution. Okay, now let me say a few more words about property of KS solution. I will switch to discussion of the running branch. This solution has global SU2 cross SU2 symmetry. It also has Z2 symmetry, which is not obvious from this slide, but it can be shown explicitly that this solution is Z2 symmetric as a geometry. It is smooth everywhere. It is imaginary self-dual, and Billiton is zero as well as axion. It has non-zero flux through S3. And this is a Calabi-Yau manifold. I say conformally because I would better say it is warped Calabi-Yau. Here it is. This is geometry of Calabi-Yau, and this is the warp factor. Okay, so I have finished discussing the Banach-Rutherford solution. I will switch to generalizations, which are known as baryonic branch of. Well, it's not correct to say that this is baryonic branch of the Banach-Rutherford because. Okay, let me start over. I will start with gauge theory, and then I will end up with gravity solutions, and I will explain what's the correct name for them. Okay, once again, I return back to my gauge theory, and I have baryonic branch. I have zero meson field and constraint. I solve the constraint. I have the symmetry on my baryonic branch in my one-dimensional complex plane, and I can address the following question. This is the baryonic branch. Zeta is a parameter in it. And I have a Banach-Rutherford solution, which is a cone. And if I know that this is a solution which is gravity dual to a gauge theory, but it's not clear where I see it in a sense of modeling space. So I can address this question, and the answer is very simple. Since this solution is Z2 invariant, and there is also Z2 symmetry which turns this branch into itself, I conclude that this solution should correspond to the unique symmetric point. This unique symmetric point is zeta equal 1, and, well, I would better say modulus zeta equal 1. So I can put that chaos corresponds to zeta equal 1 because of unbroken Z2. I also have U1 baryonic symmetry, which rotates baryons in the following way. So I have U1 symmetry. But this U1 symmetry, it is an obvious U1 symmetry of engaged theory, but there is no such a symmetry on gravity side. The corresponding solution, neither to the Banach transfer nor the solutions I will discuss later, they are not symmetric under U1. Rather, U1 acts sort of trivial. But
this arises in from the fourth.
What?
The U1 symmetry.
No, U1 symmetry. There is no U1 symmetry on the gravity side. But rather, I can discuss the following question: phi is a symmetry, so I can spontaneously break. I can spontaneously break it by choosing particular values of my baryon fields, and then I will have massless Goldstone scalar, which is actually a pseudo scalar, but this is a Goldstone particle. It has to be massless, and there is indeed such a particle on a gravity side.
I don't understand why you say there is no such symmetry. Take the fourth
one. I will explain in a second why there is no such symmetry, because I can identify this particle on the gravity side, right? And then I can ask the question if this particle can condense, right? If it can condense, there is such a symmetry. If it cannot condense, there is no such a symmetry.
So just before you go, how do I interpret zeta at this level?
Zeta is a parameter on the moduli space of gauge theory.
So it's just a parameter that necessarily occurs by solving AB is minus.
Right, right. I just have a valley in a moduli space, and I parameterize it with help of zeta.
Okay. There is a very simple symmetry. You take the four form, wrap it on the three cycle, and you get a new one symmetry. It's a good gauge field on giving a radius 5.
I take a four form, C4.
Type 2B, you wrap type 2B. Take C4, contract it with the volume form of the three cycle of T11, and that's a good gate symmetry. That's the U1B symmetry that you have.
What you refer to, I believe, is not U1B, but rather U1R, R symmetry. And
no, the U1R symmetry is part of the isometry of T11. This is not the isometry.
Well, it is broken anyway, right? U1R is broken in the solution.
Yeah, I'm not talking about U1.
Okay.
U1B is a good symmetry.
Yeah. Let us discuss that once again. What do you want me to do? You want me to take C4 and integrate it over a three cycle. So I will have a massless field. That's what you say, right?
Yeah.
Right. I agree with you. There is massless field. The point is that this field cannot condense. There is no the new solution which you want to generate by taking condensate of this field is a pure gauge change of my solution. There is a difference between real symmetry when I can change my solution and the gauge symmetry which doesn't produce me the new solution.
But he's producing for you the gauge field.
Huh?
He's giving you the gauge field.
Not the condensation. Right. The gauge field.
Gauge field, which corresponds to what?
Well, each field on ADS corresponds to baryonic symmetries.
Why do we discuss gauge field here? I have global U1, so I have a massless Goldstone scalar, right? I should better have Goldstone scalar particle, which I really have on a gravity side. I do not understand why we discuss
this is the correspondence kind of. So gauge fields on ADS correspond to baryonic symmetries. That's what I mean currently.
No, I do not agree. I think that the scalar should be scalar.
Let's not divert you from your meaning.
Well, I have a slide where I have formula which what I think corresponds to this symmetry. So maybe we will have a chance to discuss it later. Okay. So let me start discussing this family of the family of solutions. We have frozen this topic about the phase. So from now on, I will discuss only the real part, the modulus of zeta, and this should be one-dimensional real modulus. So you can address the question, if Lobanov fractal solution corresponds to this point, what does it mean if I move away from this point on a gauge side? The problem means that I will have new gravity solutions, and it was a question of how to find them. So those questions, this question was addressed or in paper by groups of Herzog and Klebanov. They found the solutions, supergravity solutions in the vicinity of this point, and then Booty, Grimes, and Assange, Petrini, and Zaffaroni, they found the whole family of solutions. And now I will discuss how they did that. I will discuss the result, basically. So the idea is the following. To find those solutions, you need to start with Papandopoulos Tatum ansatz, which is a general SV2 process U2 ansatz, which covers both geometry and fluxes. And it has 10 fields in it. This is a metric together with Dilatuan and the fluxes, 5 and 5. And the metric is pretty ugly here because it's the most generic SV2 process U2 ansatz. And then you need to find a particular solution for these 10 functions, which is a pretty messy job. So instead of looking for solution, instead of looking at equations of motion, this BGM PZ solutions, which I will refer to the solution as Baryonic branch of Kubanov-Strasser. This is not exactly correct, because Baryonic branch is something which happens at gauge theory side. So those solutions should be called BGM PZ, but this is difficult, so I will refer them as Baryonic branch of KS. So this family of solutions were not found through equations of motion, but rather they used the method of SU3 structure, and it has its own advantage because instead of looking at second order solutions, they look at first order solutions. They said the following: let's say psi is a generator, the spinner, which is a generator of N1 supersymmetry. Then if supersymmetry is preserved, the corresponding fluctuation, supersymmetry transformation of spinners should be zero, and then by multiplying by psi Dagger at the left-hand side, I can end up with one first-order differential equations for the background fields and fluxes. And they wrote down those equations and were able to solve them. So those 10 equations can be solved, all of them, through two functions, A and B. And those functions, A and B, has to be solved through a first-order system. Namely, this system has two-dimensional family of solutions. But if you fix boundary conditions to be non-singular, there is only one parameter survives. This is U is a real parameter, one real parameter. And this real parameter parameterizes the family of solutions. So after you solve A and B, you cannot do that analytically unless you're working with KS solution. So if you do that, say, numerically, after that, you plug it in formula for Dilatuan, and after that, you know all the fields more or less explicitly. There is an ambiguity in shifting Dilatuan and shifting four-dimensional work parameter. I should probably write the definition of A. This is a 10-dimensional metric. The definition of A is the following. It's E to the X squared or something. So A is four-dimensional work parameter. So there is an obvious ambiguity. You can rescale four-dimensional definition of unit matter, and you can also rescale Dilatuan. And for one particular solution, this change will not affect anything. But if you have a family of solutions, you need to be accurate, because if you have, say, two solutions and you rescale definition of four-dimensional meter here, you won't be able to compare any result here to the result from another gauge theory, because you change the definition of meter and of all the units. So there was a question on how to fix boundary conditions correctly, and we addressed this issue. And the solution which we proposed was the following. We keep boundary, we suggested to fix boundary condition in conditions in a way that the leading asymptotics of all the fields in the ultraviolet regime will be the same for the whole branch. So I have many solutions which corresponds to different points on here, and we suggested that ultraviolet behavior should be the same for all the solutions, such that all the solutions correspond to the same universality class in a sense of gauge theory. And this proposal was checked, and if I have time, I will speak about the check of this proposal. So So after you check the, after you fix boundary conditions to be the same at infinity for all values of parameter u, and you, now this constant is arbitrary, we choose it to be zero. And then you can also integrate for a, and this is a implicit formula for it, and after some work, you can also integrate expression for dilaton, which is pretty nested, but explicit. The only thing which is not known explicitly is the a, is a variable a and variable b, but it can be calculated numerically. Okay, now, this is the slide where I discuss the behavior. Well, basically, that's almost the end what I wanted to say about BGM BZ solutions. And there is also the last slide below, which will have a picture similar to this picture. So if there are some questions about the solutions, let us discuss it now. And on the next slide, I will try to return back to this axiom and say a few words about it. So if you do not have any questions, let me proceed. So my understanding of axiom, if I think, yeah.
So what would be the corresponding, say, objects that will be due to the Baryon operators on the bottom?
To what?
Due to the Baryon operators.
Baryon operators?
Yeah.
I'm going to discuss that. Okay. So that's the picture which I want to, okay, I will finish with that. So let me say a few words about how, about U1B symmetry, how I understand that. There is no such a symmetry on a gravity side because the corresponding U1 the corresponding particle, they enters through the following combination on the gravity side. Okay, so when you try to condense field phi, you get nothing. So this phi is a pseudo-scalar, and this is indeed massless, it corresponds to U1 symmetry, and you cannot condense it. That's how I understand it. If this is different from what you said before, maybe we can discuss it after the talk. It is it, right?
Doesn't help. I'm not sure what to say about this one.
Okay, maybe we can discuss it in detail after the talk. So, okay, what is really interesting about it, it would be really interesting to understand this particle, whatever it is, if it is represented in this way. I'm pretty sure it is represented in this way because there is an explicit solution for a massless fluctuation of supergravity. And it's, since it's massless, we should be able to match it to some particle in a gravity, or excuse me, on a gauge side. Because on a gauge side, we pretty much know all the massless particles. So it will be interesting to understand how this particle, massless particle, behaves when we compactify the system, because the global U1 baryon should be gauged then, and we should indeed have a gauge field, which you mentioned before. And I believe that the mass of this particle should be parametrically small if the volume of compactification is large. And this is very promising if you want to have certain models of cosmological models with parametrically light particles. So I think it will be interesting to pursue that and build a particular model of compactification and see how this particle becomes massive. Okay, that's what I just said about cosmology. So that's the main picture of the first part of my talk. That's basically the goal, the first goal of my talk. The new family of solutions, this is one-dimensional family of supergravity solutions. They all look like cones. They all have non-shrinking as three at the tip. They look pretty much the same in the UV because they have to share the same leading asymptotics as we've shown in our paper. This particular solution, the KS solution, is a Calabi-Yau. Those guys are not Calabi-Yau. And they all correspond to Baryonic branch of gauge theory. So I was welcome your questions about that, if you have. So now I will switch.
What's the meaning? Sorry, why are those two arrows identified? Are those solutions identified somehow?
Is it because they have Z2 symmetry in gauge theory.
Plus, they're identified under the Z2.
Yeah, this is Z2 which exchange A and B. This is the symmetry of the gauge theory.
Okay.
And it acts as, it turns U to be equal to minus U.
Okay.
In a physical sense. Okay, now I will start speaking about Baryonic operators. So to my goal would be to calculate expectation of the baryon. So I have a baryonic operator here, and it has some expectation value, say I'm sitting here, it has some expectation value. But I do not know what it means in terms of U, because U appeared through a solution of particular first order system. So my first task would be to relate expectation of baryonic operator to some geometry, or literally I would try to calculate expectation of A through geometric terms and then express it through parameter U. For that reason, I need to consider Euclidean defined brain. I do not have that much time to describe the details. Why? I will just briefly say why I need to consider Euclidean defined brains. So first, my baryonic operator A is not charged under SU2 cross SU2. That is why it has to work at the base of the cone, because the base of the cone is T11, it is charged under SU2 cross SU2. So if the only way to avoid charging, I need to wrap it all, that's how I spend 5 of 6 dimensions of my defined brain. Then I need to explain why I consider Euclidean brain rather Minkowski brain. For that reason, I have the following picture here.
A of x may carry spin and may carry projection of the spin. So J depends.
Well, as a baryon, I'm not sure how it can carry spin.
Because you compose it of fields A1 or A2, each one of them carries spin?
No, not really. It's not charged under C2. Yeah, A has no quantum numbers, it's a number, it's a scalar.
But you have those indices.
Where?
Which case do you choose? You have two in the Guido that you wrote down. A can be one of two.
Right, but I use them all. I use them all here. That's the explicit expression. I use them all. This guy is not charged under SU2.
So this is a contraction with a singlet?
Yeah, exactly, that's the whole point. It is different from the baryon in resolved conifold case. In resolved conifold, the baryon, I'm not sure if it is doublet or some other representation, but I know for sure that in resolved conifold case, baryon has to be charged under SU2. That's why baryon covers part of T11. In our case, baryon covers the whole T11, because it's uncharted. So the only thing I need to explain is why it is Euclidean. So I have the following picture. If I want to calculate the correlation function between two operators in ADS space, then I need to calculate the classical trajectory which stretches into ADS. If I want to calculate one point function, I will remove these points far from each other. It means that the corresponding trajectory which will stretch farther and farther in ADS space. And if I want to end up with one point function, I will just cut this trajectory here, so eventually it will go from here to infinity and will cover the internal coordinate of ADS. When I combine this picture with this picture, when I already covered the base, I will also cover internal direction. So when I combine these two pictures, I will end up with covering the whole the whole six-dimensional space. That's the Euclidean defined brain, which is dual to the baryonic operator. Okay, now since my embedding is completely fixed, I cover all the dimensions. The only thing which I need to calculate is the gauge field, and the ANSOS is very restrictive. There's only one function because it has to be SU2 cross SU2 invariant. And the tricky point is that it is not possible, at least it's not clear how to write down kappa symmetry equation for Euclidean object. But what you can do, you can just take a square root of equations of motion, just guess what would be the square root of equation of motion, and then check that certain first order equation indeed solves second order equation of motion. Or there is another trick, you can consider, it's not here on the slide, but you can just consider Minkowski denying brain, which, and kappa symmetry equation for Minkowski denying reproduces correct first order equation for Euclidean defined. Okay, so we have this first order equation. Now we need to solve it. And there's only three solutions such that this function is real. One solution has to be dropped because it has wrong UV behavior. It leads to badly divergent DBI action. So we end up with two solutions, and this is exactly what we need to describe two variants A and B. So the first good thing is that, let me stress that, I have two different solutions, zeta A and zeta B, which correspond to variants A and B, and this is very good because I have exactly enough number of solutions. And then if I change orientation of Chern-Simons theorem, I also describe antivariance. Now, still, if I put the solutions into DBI action will be divergent, but this is not bad at all because I can interpret this divergence through holomorphic renormalization group, and I can calculate dimension of Baryon operators, and through relating radius of my manifold to the running parameter of cascade, I can move this divergent term into this expression where k was on the very first slide, it's a step of the cascade. And it turns out that this naive calculation gives me exactly the same formula which I would get from gauge theory. If I just start with considering variant A or B and calculate its dimension just naively in gauge theory, I will get this formula, and the fact that I was able to reproduce it through gauge gravity duality is very encouraging. It means that I'm on the right track with my calculation. Okay, on the next step, I subtract the divergence from DBI action, and I'm ready to calculate the expectation of the Baryon operator. And there is yet another surprise, which is a nice surprise. I calculate expectation of A and B, and for all values of U, I find that their product is constant. And this is exactly the constraint of the Baryons along the Baryonic branch. So I was able to reproduce three important things. I was able to reproduce enough solutions such that I have correct number of Baryons. I reproduce their anomalous dimension, and I also reproduce the Baryonic branch constraint, and all this suggests that my calculation is indeed correct, and Euclidean D5 indeed corresponds to the Baryonic operator. So now I can do numerical work and calculate the logarithm of this parameter zeta. I cannot calculate the cut, well, I can add some parameters. Well, this constant here in front is not known because it corresponds to, I can add any constant parameter to my divergence, but I can always shift it to be zero on this slide such that my Z2 symmetry is implemented in the simplest way. And then I have the following plot which I got numerical. Okay, so now I will, do you have any questions about the Baryonic operator?
Zeta?
Well, zeta is the way how I wrote down ansatz for gauge. G5 is a particular SU2 cross SU2 invariant for on Q11, and that's the only SU2 cross SU2 invariant function, one form you can write here.
Okay, thanks. And also, if I grab some equivalence on the free sphere, about that part.
It, like Euclidean D3?
Not Euclidean, but just the honorary D3 bring you back on the 3-sphere.
What kind of operator would it be?
I mean,
it would be a charge operator, right? It will be charged under SC2 cross SC2.
That's correct. Would that also correspond to some variables in the dual field theory? I mean, that seems to be related to what Ani has been saying.
Well, let me first ask you if you can do that supersymmetric, if you can do supersymmetric embedding. I don't know the answer, but I would just roughly guess that it may be similar to what I do here, because here we consider D5 and we cover three dimensions in a four dimensional Minkowski space. We also cover three dimensions on the conifold. That's what we want to do. And there is indeed supersymmetric embedding, but only here on the tip. This is not module grain. But the story is that this grain is not charged on the SU2 across the SU2 because this is only one cycle here, which is at the tip. I cannot move it. If it would be here, it would be charged. But since it's here, it's not charged. So I'm not sure. I would rather not guess what kind of object you would get if you cover different brain. But it will be interesting to investigate that.
But there is an interesting question about what would happen if you set n to 0. Are you able to do that?
The number of colors?
Yes.
Well, technically, if I set number of colors to 0, I immediately break gauge gravity duality. Because gauge gravity duality is based on the fact that my curvature is not large anywhere. And for that reason, I need a sufficiently large radius of S3. Right? So really, my geometry is not M dependent. M can be factorized. So in some sense, you can take M to be equal 1 or some small number. But you need to be careful if the predictions, if you will do some predictions, if those predictions are reliable. So maybe you can specify what you want to consider after taking M to be 0.
Well, the conformal field theory is well understood. So the equation that Xiao is using is in the conformal field theory. And you are dealing with a case which involves conformal symmetry by this quantum number A. So the question is, can you recover the limit, conformal limit, by setting M to 0?
No. If you take, if you're able to take M, well, I wouldn't say you reproduce conformal limit. You need to be accurate. You need to take. The problem is that the geometry is not singular. So if you just change M and take it to 0, you either have just 0 everywhere, or you cannot change the topology. The topology of the deformed manifold is not the same as the topology of singular manifold. So you may reproduce it asymptotically in some regime by taking M very small, but you cannot just jump from one geometry to another. Okay, so can I move on? So okay, maybe I can say a few words about the firebrain, and perhaps it will be related to what you want to do with the three brain. So if you consider the five brain, which is a domain wall in gauge theory, then it has to be a domain wall between two supersymmetric vacua, and that's why its tension should be independent on a location on a Baryonic branch. And we try to understand how it works on a we try to understand how it works on a gravity side. And for that reason, we consider the five brain. And it has to work, to be supersymmetric, it has to work the tip of the conifold that's the only supersymmetric embedding. And to understand why the tension here is equal to the tension here, one can use, well, first, let me say that the tension of this object is very sensitive to boundary conditions, because if you change the electron or you change four-dimensional unit, if you change work factor, then you also change tension of this brain. And if you expect the tension of the corresponding domain wall is the same for all u's, it will, for all values of parameter u, this should be very sensitive on how you choose boundary conditions. So that's a nice check of our logic. And in our original paper, we calculated this tension numerically, and it was flat. It was u-independent with very good accuracy, and we concluded that that is good enough to say that our boundary conditions are indeed correct. Okay, now we tried to do the same using analytical methods. Those methods were developed in a set of papers by Martucci and Smith, and now we are working on applying those methods to this particular situation. So the logic is the following. The DBI action of the fire brain can be calibrated by the integral of holomorphic three-form omega. I didn't say that, but this is important part of this picture, is that the metric of this solution is not equal to metric of this solution. But as a complex manifold, this manifold is the same as this complex manifold. That is why I have a holomorphic closed form here, and I have the same form here. But nothing will happen with this form if I multiply it by some number. So when I have this form here, it is not known which particular form it is, because I can multiply it by some number. But this is a key observation. The DBI action is calibrated by holomorphic form. So if I want to calculate it at the minimal cycle, I can actually calculate integral of omega. But integral of omega can be calculated anywhere at any S3 cycle because omega is closed. So the idea is the following. Instead of calculating anything at the tip, I pull my three-cycle to UV region and calculate integral there. And there I also use the fact that I choose boundary conditions in a way that in the UV region, the geometry of every solution is the same. And that's why the integral of omega in the UV region over the same cycle has to be the same for all values of U. And in this way, you can nicely show that the tension of defined brain is U-independent. Okay, so the next thing I would maybe speak 2 or 3 minutes about putting D3 brain on the running branch. But this D3 brain is nothing else as space-filling brain. It's not what you want to do in a sense that it fills Minkowski space rather than 3 dimensions on a compact manifold. So on a conifold, the D3 brain and anti-D3 brain is a point. And if it is supersymmetric, the corresponding tension is zero. But the fact is that anti-D3 brain is not symmetric, is not supersymmetric anywhere. And D3 brain is supersymmetric only for KS solution. So we can try to understand what's the potential for the D3 and anti-D3. So as I said, D3 is supersymmetric for Klebanov-Strassmann solution. We can easily derive that from the explicit formula for a Keeling spinner. I would rather skip this technical part and just say that, let me just repeat where each of the brains are supersymmetric or not. Any D3 breaks Suzy everywhere, D3 breaks Suzy away from KS, and it is supersymmetric at the KS. So we can explicitly calculate the tension through calculating DBI action. And any D3 brain sitting at the tip produces the following tension as a function of U. And this is the formula over here. And D3 brain produces this tension, and it is zero at U equals zero because here supersymmetry is not broken. And we can also plot the same thing. We can also move D3 brain away from the tip along the cone, and then the corresponding tension is very, very flat. So the first idea when we saw this potential, the first idea was that this could be a good model for D-term supersymmetry breaking, which can be good for cosmology because the corresponding D-term is very, very flat. If you recalculate this term in the normal units, in the correctly normalized units, it will not be that flat, but still it would be somewhat flat. It would be 1 over phi squared, where phi dot squared is a canonical kinetic term. So this is D-term. And here we have U squared. So in this way, we have a good mechanism to break supersymmetry by D-term in a controllable way, in a sense that U can be chosen to be very, very small. And in some sense, it would be a controllable breaking of supersymmetry. And this is quite flat. By itself, this potential cannot reproduce inflation, anything like that. But if you combine it with other terms, perhaps it can be useful to reproduce inflation. So that was our initial idea, and it is still appealing. I have to say that this idea is not self-consistent, not 100% self-consistent, because in a compact case, a parameter U is not a free parameter. It will be fixed somehow by compactification, and it's not clear if it is possible to make a setup such that the parameter U will be very small. And if it is not small, then the advantage of this mechanism is not that big. The real advantage of this mechanism is to keep U small, and that's why the supersymmetry will be broken in a controllable way. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say. I will just repeat that.
Wait, what is U from the field theory?
U is the expectation of the variable. So we are sitting somewhere here. That's the valley. when we compactify this theory to gravity, this value will be lifted somehow. That's the effect of compactification. So it will be something like that. So this is zeta equal 1. This is Cubano Kruskal. But this is a flat direction. When I compactify it, it will be like that. So you will sit somewhere here. It's not clear if you can do that, if you can come up with different scenarios, and if you can really choose this point to be close to where to point zeta equal 1, because here supersymmetry is not broken. And if you indeed can control this point, then you can sort of break supersymmetry in a controllable way. But this is very difficult to understand, because for that you need to somehow model the compactification effects, and this is by itself a very complicated task. Okay, so the same problem arises when you try to fix U by Fayet-Laplace term. You can just modify your gauge theory by adding Fayet-Laplace term, and it will also fix the value of Veronica condensate, but that's the same problem, because Fayet-Laplace term should be generated dynamically in the string theory background, and we do not know the value of Fayet-Laplace term if it is small or big. It's the same sort of ambiguity here. Okay, so I probably do I have 5 minutes or? Okay, so let me just say a few words about calculating of masses of low-lying globules. We can do that by considering fluctuation of supergravity, and the simplest example is the traceless components of stress-energy tensor. We need to consider fluctuation of four-dimensional metric, which is traceless, and then with appropriate, if we switch to from string frame to Einstein frame, and we separate work parameter, then the corresponding function, non-trivial function, which is a function in internal dimensions. This guy depends on, okay, let me write it here. Zeta is a polarization and also depends on four-dimensional momentum, such that k squared is equal to m squared. So the only non-trivial thing here is to find fluctuation along the deformed manifold, along the radius of deformed manifold. This is function of radius of deformed manifold. And it turns out that stress, the fluctuations of stress energy tensor I described through minimal scalar equation. This is a very well known fact. It is true for very general setup. It is definitely true for any solution which I considered here. For all the solutions along the Baryonic branch, fluctuations of stress energy tensor are described through minimal scalar. Okay, now actually these fluctuations of the stress energy tensor, this is particle of spin 2, it forms the gravity multiplet, it also has a particle of spin 3 halves, it also has a vector, a transversal component of an anomalous chiral symmetry current, which is a vector. And you can try to find fluctuation, identify this fluctuation on a gravity side. It was done in a paper by Klebanova, Young, and Witten. They said that the one of the angles of T11, it was a symmetry. If you consider this geometry away from the tip, this is a symmetry which is broken in the infrared. But they said that you should gauge the symmetry by adding gauge field to this angle. And Krasnitz, in his paper, consider that consistently for UV region of Klebanov-Strasberg solution. And in our recent work with Melnikov, we extended this analysis to infrared region. And indeed, we found the solution for this. We found the equation for this fluctuation. So again, zeta is some polarization, and phi is the field which you have to find. It's a field which lives on a column. And there is a similar analysis which was done in five-dimensional effect of supergravity, and we were able to check that our equation coincides with their equation. So this equation to get form one-dimensional supersymmetric quantum mechanics with minimal scalar, because those particles, they lie in the same supermultiplet, so they have the same four-dimensional mass. Okay, now they have two equations which reproduce the same spectrum Now, what we did, we calculated the spectrum numerically, and we actually calculated it for both equations because it was a sort of an easy way to estimate a numerical Gero bar. And it turns out that the simple shooting algorithm gives you a Gero bar of more than 1%. One more thing, analytically, we can show that we calculated the spectrum for all the points along the Baryonic branch. Well, not all of them. Baryonic branch is infinite in that sense. But we calculated it for values from 150 to minus 150. And analytically, we can show that each particular mass behaves as u to the power 4 to the 3 along as parameter u increases. And for each particular parameter u, you have a tower here, and the mass is proportional to m. This is different from the reject trajectory in the usual QCD. This is related, this is like a common weak point of gravity duals, why they're different from usual QCD. This is because gravity duals are based on throughout geometries, conic geometries. If you consider Laplacian on a usual conic geometry, you always will get this guy. But on a physical level, those theories are not that different. If you will increase number n, the size of fluctuation along the cone should increase. So if you have a compact cone, what we should really have. At some point, the size of fluctuation will reach the size of cone, and the character of this law will change. Instead of proportionality to n, we should have proportionality of n squared. But this is, of course, not possible to reach in our setup, because if you consider such a big fluctuation, the supergravity approximation is not valid anymore. Okay, so another thing is that there is anomaly multiplet, which was studied separately by Arutyunov, Filova, and Faison, and Wolff and Friedman, and they found two different equations, and they also found that the solutions to these equations coincide in a few particular examples they considered. After some simple consideration, we found that those solutions also form supersymmetric quantum mechanics, and one solution corresponds to a scalar as a trace of stress energy tensor, and another scalar, this is a scalar, this is a pseudo-scalar. There is also a fermion of spin 1/2 in this multiplet, which nobody considered. It has the same mass, obviously. And another part of this multiplet is a longitudinal part of chiral current. And we also calculated the mass of this. They both proposed five-dimensional equations for these particles. And we start with this equation. One equation is enough to recover mass. So we calculated the mass and numerically, and we compared this mass with mass of gravity multiplet. So we have gravity in blue and anomaly multiplet in red. And you see that those masses never intersect such that there is no degeneracy. And anomaly multiplet is a little bit lighter, but the properties are the same. Mass is proportional to n. And it has the same behavior. When u increases, n increases as u to the power of 4 to the 3. OK, there is another paper which I did not mention here. There's a collaboration which calculated 7 or 8 other particles in the same setup for Klebanov thruster, but we couldn't identify neither gravity nor anomaly multiplet among those 9 particles. So I didn't put this information here. It could be 9 more particles over here. In principle, there's 16 scalar particles in this setup. It would be interesting to identify all of them and understand the dual operators.
What sets the scale of that separation?
Well, obviously, this is a dimensional scale. There is the choice. This is m squared. You can introduce any number here, right? So the question really is the following. What's the meaning of m anomaly and minus m gravity and divided by m gravity, right?
Sure.
Well, that's a physical difference. It's the same. That's the observable difference in four-dimensional gauge theory. You have two different particles. They have two different masses.
There must be some parameter that tells you how big that's going to be.
Well, it's not a simple question because this is deep infrared, so you do not know the details of the dynamics. The story is that if you have singular kind of fault before you start considering renormalization group flows and fluxes, those particles should be degenerate. And there is one more degenerate particle, a dilaton, which corresponds to. Okay, the corresponding gauge theory operator is also known, but I will not name it because I need to write it otherwise. It's a linear combination of trace F squared. We have two gauge fields, so we have linear combinations of two trace F squared. So there are three particles, they're all degenerate. But when we introduce fluxes and we have non-trivial renormalization group, they're not degenerate anymore. So we do not really know why we have this number here and why this number changes when we change u. You would say that this is natural because there is no symmetry which keeps them the same. Okay. So actually this is the last slide in my presentation. Let me just briefly conclude. It will not take more than 1 minute. So the first message of my talk is that there is a family of solutions which are known more or less explicitly. They're known explicitly in the sense that part of the work should be done numerically. And those solutions provide gravity dual description for a Brownian branch of certain n equal 1 supersymmetric young Mills theory. And this theory exhibits rich infrared dynamics, which can be studied via brain fluctuations of supergravity and other tools. And this is interesting in the sense that those building blocks, which I partially discussed today, can be applied to cosmology. They can be used to better understand breaking of supersymmetry in a sort of half-controllable way. And there's one more interesting direction to study is the compactification effects, because it's a good toy model for compactification of gravity duals. Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Any questions? So if there are no questions, let's thank the speaker again.